and welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Monday, October 18th, 2021. I'm your reader, Paula Carezzi. Monday's weather in the Dubuque area will be mild with plenty of sunshine. The high will be 70 with an overnight low of 47. On the front page of Monday's Telegraph Herald is an article by Benjamin Fisher titled, Reports Show Big Money Flowing Into Area Races. Democrat Abby Finkenauer touts fundraising win against incumbent Republican Chuck Grassley. Recently released fundraising reports from the third quarter show big money already flowing into area congressional races long before the 2022 election. The quarter from July 1st to September 30th also was the first for several candidates now vying for area seats, and some of them made strong early showings. Two Republicans who lost close races in 2020 continued fundraising surges following incumbents' decisions to not run for re-election. Quarterly reports were due to the Federal Elections Commission by 11:59 p.m. Friday, and several local ones were not turned in until mere hours before that deadline. U.S. Senate, Iowa. Former U.S. Representative Abby Finkenauer, a Democrat from Iowa, outraised longtime U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, a Republican from Iowa, during her first quarter in the race. Finkenauer raised more than $1 million since she entered the race in late July. That, plus a $20,000 transfer from her unsuccessful 2020 U.S. House of Representatives campaign, brought her total contributions to $1.02 million. She spent $422,051 during the quarter and ended it with $598,351 on hand. Quote, "We are building a campaign that Senator Grassley has never seen before, holding him accountable for his allegiance to Big Pharma, Wall Street, and the Washington, D.C. elite over hardworking Iowans," Finkenauer said in a release. Grassley reported about $825,000 in total receipts for the quarter, about $595,000 in contributions, and about $230,000 in transfers. He spent about $310,000 and ended the period with $3.06 million on hand. Quote, "I'm working as hard as ever for the people of Iowa, and there's more work to do," Grassley said in a statement when he announced he was running for re-election. Quote, "In a time of crisis and polarization, Iowa needs strong, effective leadership. I'm focused on serving the people of Iowa as your senator and fighting for policies that will make Iowa an even better place to raise a family and grow a business," end quote. And the timing of Grassley's long-awaited announcement is worth noting. Finkenauer's campaign heralded her outraising Grassley as, quote, "a disastrous result," end quote, for the longtime senator. But Grassley did not officially announce he was running for re-election until September 24th, with about 1 week left in the third quarter. The other declared candidates in the race reported meager fundraising. By comparison, Iowa Senator James Carlin, a Republican from Sioux City, reported raising $94,205 in the quarter, spending $101,537 during that time, and ending it with $1,487. Western Iowa physician Dr. Glenn Hurst, a Democrat, reported raising $32,131, spending $86, and ending with $32,045. Western Iowa farmer and Democrat Dave Mulbauer reported raising $27,210, spending $41,285, and ending with $46,034. U.S. Senate, Wisconsin. U.S. Senator Ron Johnson, a Republican from Wisconsin, has not announced whether he will run for re-election. But his campaign still brought in $906,290 and spent $316,936. He ended the quarter with $2.3 million in cash on hand. State Treasurer Sarah Godlewski reported the most in receipts among a packed Democratic field in the race, though about half of that came in from a loan. She reported $1.36 million, thanks in part to a $685,000 loan. She spent $818,000 and ended the quarter with more than $786,000. Democratic Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes, whose campaign was announced July 20th, brought in $1.13 million. It spent $419,033 and ended the quarter at $711,089. Democrat Alex Lassery, on leave as an executive with the Milwaukee Bucks, brought in $1.05 million in the quarter, although $750,000 of that was a loan, ending with $1.52 million cash on hand. Outagamie County Executive Tom Nelson collected about $223,000 in contributions and ended with nearly $420,000 on hand. Wausau radiologist Jillian Bettino raised $88,926 in the quarter, the fifth highest total in the loaded field. U.S. Senate, Illinois. U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth, a Democrat from Illinois, brought in $1.82 million in the quarter, spent $1.04 million, and ended with $5.77 million cash on hand. Illinois Senate races are always the region's biggest statewide fundraisers. New challenger Republican Bobby Pittman raised $102,225, including a $25,000 loan, and ended with $84,308. Republican Peggy Hubbard raised $5,235 and ended with $4,497. Republican Tim Arview raised $120. U.S. House of Representatives, Iowa. First-term U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson, a Republican from Iowa, reported another bell ringer of a fundraising quarter, bringing in just more than $1 million in the race for the first congressional district seat. Of that, $946,708 was in individual contributions. Another $55,013 was in transfers from other political committees. Hinson's campaign spent $521,729, ending the period with $1,433,961. Iowa Senator Liz Mathis, a Democrat from Hiawatha, reported raising $641,688 since announcing her candidacy for Hinson's seat in late July. She spent $87,113, ending with $554,576. U.S. House of Representatives, Wisconsin. Derek Van Orden, the Republican candidate who narrowly lost to U.S. Representative Ron Kind, a Democrat from Wisconsin, in 2020, reported raising a notable $1.07 million in the quarter, all in individual contributions. Van Orden reported spending $429,912, ending the period with $1.25 million cash on hand in the race for the 3rd Congressional District. Kind announced in August that he would not run for re-election. Democrats' Wisconsin Senator Brad Pfaff of Onalaska and Eau Claire businesswoman Rebecca Cook both announced earlier this month, after the third quarter ended, that they would run for the seat. In the 2nd Congressional District, U.S. Representative Mark Polkin, a Democrat from Wisconsin, raised $148,389, spent $84,362, and ended the quarter with $1.01 million. New Republican challenger Charity Barry raised $5,239, spent $4,821, and ended with $418. U.S. House of Representatives, Illinois. Another return challenger from 2020 ballots, Republican Esther Joy King, reported raising $377,233 in her second bid for Illinois' 17th Congressional District. The incumbent who narrowly defeated her, Democrat U.S. Representative Sherry Bustos, is not running for re-election. Outgoing incumbents. Ron Kind, a Democrat from Wisconsin, received more than $101,600 in contributions since July 1st. So his campaign refunded more than $94,500 of that by September 30th. He also spent $141,000 in net operating expenditures. That left him, after decades in office, with $1.26 million yet in cash on hand. Bustos announced she was not seeking re-election earlier than Kind and did not report any contributions this quarter. But her campaign reported refunding $6,212. They also reported $33,360 in net operating expenditures ending the period with $998,364. In a Page 2 article, Benjamin Fisher writes, Hillcrest unveils Access Me Care System. Mobile app will help people in need make contact with service providers. Hillcrest Family Services is rolling out a system that includes a mobile application to help guide area residents in need of mental health and other social services quickly and easily. The system is known as the Access Me Care Hillcrest. It is designed to act as a single portal for dozens of area providers and organizations to help people access care based on their own determinants of health without a lot of red tape and research. Quote, this platform can go with anybody, said John Bellini, Chief Business Development Officer for Hillcrest. Quote, you can be in the community talking to somebody. They can say, I have this concern. Instead of telling them to call Hillcrest, you can get onto this app and say, what are you looking for? In 6 clicks and 90 seconds, you can make that referral. That referral will come in live in real time. End quote. The app is available for service provider organizations to join and be connected to the system. Eventually, it will be live for clients via a device, but also through a series of touchscreen kiosks to be installed in various locations. Quote, we want these kiosks to be where people are, Bellini said. We can send it to the Multicultural Family Center. If people are presenting there, we want one down there. To reduce the stigma, we need to bring access to care to them. End quote. On the screen, someone can choose among basic needs, brain health, transportation, primary care and wellness, and housing categories. By selecting one, a list of organizations and providers available to fill those needs, as well as criteria for care, are listed. Eventually, referrals even will be able to be made with the press of a button. The program will bypass the research needed for a client to find services they need, according to Hillcrest Director of Certified Community Behavioral Health Clinics and Community Outreach Programs, Janae Schmidt. Quote, it would take you much longer if you had to access to internet as a client to find the information that lives on here, she said. It's a very personalized to the community we have, end quote. The program also will allow Hillcrest staff to collect data on if and how clients are receiving care and where needs lie. Quote, what we've done in the past in social services is a big leap of faith, she said. You're meeting with someone and say you can get that referral down to Substance Abuse Services Center or Crescent Community Health Center. Then we hope and pray that they go. You see them in 3 months and they say, no, I didn't get to do that. There's no tracking. Then you have to start over. With this system, we can know if that person presented, end quote. Bellini added that the system also could help identify barriers to services, such as a person who missed an appointment because they are not on a bus route. So far, more than 30 health and service providers and area nonprofits are connected to Hillcrest's program. Hillcrest is in the process of training those partners through the end of November before a full public rollout. The first year of the Access Me Care program is being refunded through an $80,000 grant from the Mental Health Disability Services of the East Central Region, in addition to supplemental funding from federal grants and COVID-19 relief funds to Hillcrest. Hillcrest has applied to the Dubuque County Board of Supervisors for future funding for the program. In news and brief from the tri-state area, Illinois urges residents to participate in worldwide earthquake drill. Do you know what to do in an earthquake? Illinois officials are urging the public to prepare by participating in a worldwide drill they say is the world's largest. The drill, known as Shakeout, is scheduled for Thursday morning. The Illinois Emergency Management Agency says roughly 200,000 people in Illinois already have registered for the event, which is designed to draw attention to earthquake hazards in the state and around the world. Participants may register online to receive information about earthquakes and how to prepare. At the time of the drill, they'll practice the so-called drop, cover, and hold on, dropping to the ground on their hands and knees, covering the head and neck with one arm to protect from falling objects, and holding on to a sturdy desk or table until shaking stops. According to the Illinois State Geological Survey, there are earthquakes in Illinois about once every year, though damaging earthquakes are much less frequent. Quote, fire drills and tornado drills are common practices in schools and at businesses, but not everyone knows what they should do in the event of an earthquake, said IEMA Director Alicia Tate-Nadeau. Quote, we cannot predict when or where the next devastating earthquake will occur, but we can help people learn how to protect themselves and reduce damage to their homes." End quote. In an article titled "Property Rehabilitation Event Shows Preservation's Role in Sustainability," Bennett Goldstein writes, "Sue Kearns removed the vinyl siding on her newly purchased duplex on Sunday to reveal the original wood underneath. It dates to 1873 when the building was constructed in an Italianate vernacular style. The beams were solid, and she knew that, with restoration, the duplex's old bones could withstand decades more use. Quote, it's like rescuing a kitten or a puppy, she said. You fall in love, you get attached, you give it all your tender love and care." End quote. Kearns, a Dubuque resident, a retired information technology professional, and self-taught preservationist, is undertaking her fifth restoration. The duplex at 360 East 16th Street in Dubuque's Washington neighborhood was the site of a weekend wood restoration workshop overseen by Bob Yap, an expert and former host of About Your House. Nearly 20 people participated. "Dubuque is ripe with historic buildings, in structurally sound condition, but in need of maintenance," said Dwayne Haggerty, CEO of Heritage Works. Quote, there is a wide gap between good housing and really poor housing, he said. These types of projects, where they are renovating these older homes, would provide good, affordable housing for people in this neighborhood, end quote. Heritage Works planned the free event to introduce local contractors, homeowners, and tradespeople to specialize in woodworking skills, knowledge of which is splintering much like the historic structures that restoration experts hope to preserve. Restoration of old buildings plays a crucial role in sustainability, as the production of new building materials contributes mightily to the world's pollution and climate change crises, Yap said. Quote, when they burned all the coal to run the mills to make the wood and the kilns, that pollution was already created in the 1800s, he said. To ignore that is an environmental nightmare, end quote. Landfills are filling up with construction and demolition debris. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency estimated that 600 million tons were generated in 2018, more than twice the amount of solid waste generated by municipalities. Workshop participants filled rotting sections of wooden siding with epoxy, then applied primer atop the boards. Later, the public was invited to join an architectural walking tour of the Washington neighborhood. Kearns hopes to complete her restoration by the winter of 2022 and estimates she will have invested about $150,000. She might move into the residence herself or rent the entire property. The duplex is within walking distance of the Millwork District, and she envisions a young tenant taking up residence while employed at the Dupaco Community Credit Union offices at East 10th and Jackson Streets. Quote, we talk about building community, Kearns said. These buildings were the original community. They had their restaurants, their grocery stores were in the neighborhood, their neighborhood bars were here. They could walk to work. End quote. In U.S. News in Brief, removed Robert E. Lee statue now on display at Texas Resort. A statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee that the city of Dallas removed from a park and later sold in an online auction is now on display at a golf resort in West Texas. The bronze sculpture, which was removed from the Dallas Park in September 2017, is now at the Lajitas Golf Resort in Terlingua, Texas, the Houston Chronicle reported. The 27,000-acre resort, which is privately owned by Dallas billionaire and pipeline mogul Kelsey Warren and managed by Scott Beasley, the president of Dallas-based WSB Resorts and Clubs, received the statue as a donation in 2019. Beasley told the Chronicle the statue serves no intent but to preserve, quote, a fabulous piece of art, end quote. In world news in brief, according to the Japanese Prime Minister, Fukushima wastewater release can't be delayed. Japan's new prime minister on Sunday said the planned mass disposal of wastewater stored at the tsunami-wrecked Fukushima nuclear plant cannot be delayed, despite concerns from local residents. Speaking at his first visit to the facility since taking office, Fumio Kishida said his government would work to reassure residents nearby the plant about the technical safety of the wastewater disposal project. The Fukushima Daiichi plant suffered a triple meltdown in 2011 following a massive earthquake and tsunami. Kishida's brief tour of the facility by its operator, Tokyo Electric Power Company Holdings, focused on the ongoing decommissioning of the plant and the massive amount of treated but still radioactive water stored there. Quote, I felt strongly that the water issue is a crucial one that should not be pushed back, Kishida told reporters after the tour. Poles protest pushbacks of migrants at border with Belarus. Thousands of protesters marched Sunday in two Polish cities in solidarity with migrants and asylum seekers at the Poland-Belarus border who have been pushed back by Polish authorities. Thousands of people marched in Warsaw and others protested in Krakow under the slogan, Stop Torture at the Border. Marchers accused authorities of cruel behavior for pushing the migrants back and for imposing a state of emergency at the border that has prevented human rights workers from going there to aid people. Quote, how many bodies lie in the forest, read one sign in Warsaw, referring to several deaths that have occurred in the border's regions, forests, and swamps. Many carried flags made of emergency foil, a reference to the blankets the migrants trapped outdoors at the border need now as temperatures fall to freezing at night. And in news from India, heavy rains and landslides leave 18 dead in South India. At least 18 people have died a day after torrential rains swept through villages and flooded roads in the southern Indian state of Kerala. Officials said rescuers recovered the bodies of two of the worst-hit districts, Kottayam and Idukki, where the heavy downpours triggered massive landslides, according to the Press Trust of India, PTI, news agency. The National Disaster Response Force and the Indian Army deployed teams to help with rescue efforts, as several are still feared to be missing. Let's turn now to the opinion page of Monday's Telegraph Herald. It includes an Other View column written by Scott Reeder, a veteran statehouse journalist and a freelance reporter based in Springfield, Illinois. His column is titled, Parole Can Provide Hope for Prisoners, But Pain for Others. Quote, Ma'am, I've got some good news for you. Your grandson is being released from prison. End quote. I made that phone call about 20 years ago after covering a session of the Illinois Prisoner Review Board and seeing the board members vote to parole a long-serving inmate. The elated grandmother dropped the phone receiver and screamed, quote, thank you, Jesus, end quote. I could hear her feet thumping and relatives hollering with joy. Cheers roared across the phone line, and then there was silence. The grandmother came back on the phone and whispered, quote, which one of my grandsons is getting out, end quote. Illinois abolished its parole system in 1978. In the decades since, most of the people sentenced under the old parole system have been released. Fewer than 50 of the 38,000 inmates in the state's prison system are eligible for parole. But there is a movement afoot in the legislature to bring parole back so inmates serving life sentences can have some hope of release. During the past 33 years, I've learned a lot about parole and the pain that remains decades after a loved one is killed. When I was a young reporter in Galveston, Texas, in 1988, I covered a shooting at a daycare center. A gunman entered, shot and killed one teacher, and wounded another in front of 30 screaming kids. For years, my wife pestered me to return to Galveston County and follow up on the story. She wanted to know how the trauma affected the kids and what the ramifications of the crime were for everyone involved. So, 4 years ago, I returned and wrote that story. The killer, Clyde Buddy Spence, became eligible for parole after serving 7 years of his 30-year sentence. For more than 20 years, brothers and sisters of the woman who was murdered wrote the Texas Parole Board asking that Spence not be released. Quote, it's horrible, said one of the sisters, Kim Barksdale. I can't think of a better word. It's just horrible. It's very emotional. Every year we've done it. We wrote the letters and got petitions and got the newspaper to do an article on him. It was very emotional, stressful. You almost want to just give up and say, fine, let him out. That way, you don't have to relive everything. You can't just walk in and say, hey, will you sign the petition? Everybody wants to know why. What is it? And then they say, oh, I'm so sorry, I didn't realize it was your sister. Everybody remembers. End quote. And there is the rub. Proponents of bringing back parole in Illinois see it as a compassionate move to give hope to inmates who have changed for the better. But the families of those killed often see it as dooming them to relive the crime at hearing after hearing for years to come. When I visited Spence, the killer, in prison, he shared that it was difficult to be denied parole year after year. Even though he participated in multiple programs to improve himself, he was resigned to being denied parole a final time before his 30-year sentence was complete. For him, the parole system fostered nothing but false hope. But there are people in our prison system who don't belong there. Some are wrongly convicted. Others were wrongly sentenced. And some folks have turned their lives around and become much better people than when they entered prison. A perplexing phenomenon I've observed is that murder victims' families often equate the value of their loved one's life to the severity of the punishment their killer receives. All life is precious, and sadly, no matter how much punishment is meted out, the grief remains. I've heard victims' families talk about a need for so-called closure and express hope that seeing a criminal punished would give them just that. Perhaps closure is like a period at the end of a sentence, or the amen at the end of a prayer. It's a signal to move on to something new. But here is the thing. I've never met a person who found closure from watching someone else suffer, but I did encounter a woman who found peace decades after her husband was murdered. After getting off the phone with the grandma celebrating her grandson's release, I called a nursing home to talk to the widow of the man who he killed. The widow came to the phone, and I explained that her husband's killer was going free. There was a long pause, and she said, quote, "It's time to forgive and move on," end quote. Again, this is the opinion of Scott Reeder. Monday's opinion page also includes a column by syndicated columnist Clarence Page of the Chicago Tribune. His column is titled, "Dave Chappelle's Pushing Back Against Cancel Culture Chills the Joke." Dave Chappelle is in hot water again, testing the boundaries of public sensibilities so you don't have to. Netflix is defending his latest comedy special, The Closer. Critics, particularly in the LGBTQ community and their allies, want it taken down, charging his offbeat and often off-color monologue is transphobic. I'm not surprised. This is Chappelle's sixth special for Netflix, and it quickly soared to the streaming service's top five list, where it remained as I watched it twice this past week. By now, Chappelle is more than a celebrity jokester. He's a cultural force. He's won 5 Emmy Awards and 3 Grammys, as well as the prestigious Mark Twain Prize. His appeal, as with other topical comedians, comes from his ability to challenge the contradictions in society's sacred cows and survive. For him, that means plunging boldly into 3 areas that we tend to be the most nervous about discussing in mixed company or in front of the children: sex, race, and politics. For example, he defends Harry Potter author J.K. Rowling, who has been accused of transphobia for her fears of what she calls, quote, "the new trans activism," end quote. In the blog post, she recently explained that she has, quote, 5 reasons for being worried about it," end quote, and decided to speak up. Among her reasons, she mentions her charity for women and children, being an ex-teacher, her interest in free speech, her concern about, quote, "the huge explosion in young women wishing to transition," end quote, and her experience as a victim of sexual and domestic abuse. I don't share her alarm by any means, but I do defend her right to express it without being viciously attacked, which only makes opponents of trans rights more determined. It also silences the honest discussions that need to take place so she and others can learn how trans individuals really feel and live. "Of all the criticisms made against Chappelle," he recalled, quote, "my least favorite said I was, quote, punching down," end quote, on them. What does that mean? End quote. That's a good thing for him to learn. An old saying in comedy and politics advises, quote, "always punch up," end quote, with your attacks. Never punch down at people who are less empowered than you are. But Chappelle had a hard time with that, he says, because he sees LGBTQ communities as gaining power and influence and respect at a faster rate than black people. Quote, "gender is a fact," he argued. Well, yes and no. The many social and psychological aspects of what comprises transgender identity are complicated and confusing, as I have found after years of reading and discussions, so I'm not surprised by the confusion. But this example only illustrates how we need to have more public discussion about these topics, not less. Silencing or, quote, canceling, end quote, people who express their earnest beliefs, no matter how poorly informed, can only add to the confusion and social divisions. In short, some complex topics are too complex to be easily handled just for laughs. But Chappelle helped redeem himself as he began to close the show out with memories of a friend and fellow comedian, Daphne Dorman, a transgender woman he had struck up a friendship with and opened a conversation about identity. Sadly, Chappelle concluded the story by recounting how Dorman took her own life in 2019, shortly after defending him online. Quote, "I don't know what the trans community did for her," Chappelle said, "but I don't care because I feel like she wasn't their tribe. She was mine. She was a comedian in her soul," end quote. He finished with an open announcement to LGBTQ folks. Quote, "I'm not going to tell another joke about you until we are both sure that we are laughing together," end quote. That was reassuring, although his final request was less so. Quote, "All I ask from your community, with all humility," he said, "will you please stop punching down on my people," end quote. What? As if there aren't also black LGBTQ people? Regardless of color, folks in the LGBTQ community that I know still don't see themselves as all that empowered. Obviously, we still have a lot of talking to do in this great diverse nation of ours, and a lot of listening, too. No joke. Again, this is Clarence Page's column in Monday's Telegraph Herald. You are listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Monday, October 18, 2021, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Doreen M. Thibault, aged 68, known as Dee, of Cedar Rapids, passed away peacefully at St. Luke's Hospice on Saturday, October 16th. A memorial service will be held at 2 p.m. on Friday, October 22nd, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids, with a visitation 1 hour prior. Doreen Marie was born on March 5, 1953, in Cedar Rapids, to Leo Thomas and Gladys Marie Walston Phillipson. Dee enjoyed traveling, glamping, puzzles, spending time with family and friends, and always lit up when seeing young children. In recent years, as she struggled with treatments for lung cancer, she and Mike spent many hours enjoying each other's company. Dee is survived by her husband, Mike, three sons, Dustin and Jenny Bruce of Council Bluffs, Damien and Heather Bruce of Vinton, and Dylan Bruce of Cedar Rapids, six grandchildren, one great-granddaughter, her sister, Karen Thomas Shelmeland of Ely, and special friend Bernie Blazek of Cedar Rapids. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the University of Iowa Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center. Please share a memory of Dee at murdochfuneralhome.com under obituaries. Kenneth J. Kloss, aged 65, of Lancaster, Wisconsin, died Saturday, October 16th. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, October 22nd, and from 10 to 11 a.m. Saturday, October 23rd, at St. Clement Catholic Church in Lancaster. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday at the church, followed by burial in St. Clement Cemetery. Martin Short's Funeral Home of Lancaster is assisting the family. Donald R. Harrelson, age 96, of Cuba City, died on Sunday, October 17th. Visitation will be held from 10 to 10:45 a.m. Wednesday, October 20th, at Faith Lutheran Church in Cuba City, where a funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. Burial will be in Mount Pleasant Cemetery in Cuba City. Casey McNett Funeral Home and Cremation Services of Cuba City is assisting the family. Funeral services announced in Monday's Telegraph Herald include those for Mary E. Otterman of Monona. Visitation will be 9 to 11 a.m. Tuesday, October 19th at St. Patrick Catholic Church in Monona. Mass of Christian burial will be at 11 a.m. Tuesday at the church. Services for Mariella M. Berthel of Dubuque include visitation from 2 to 6 p.m. on Sunday, October 24th, with a scripture wake service at 6 p.m. Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory Mass of Christian burial will be 11 a.m. Monday, October 25th at St. Anthony's Catholic Church. Services for Louise E. Brockman of Platteville include visitation from 4 to 7 p.m. today and 9 to 10 a.m. on Tuesday, October 19th at First English Lutheran Church in Platteville. Service will be at 10 a.m. Tuesday at the church. Services for Harold N. Buchheit of Dubuque include visitation from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, October 19th at Hoffman Schneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Cremation Service on Asbury Road. Mass of Christian Burial will be at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, October 19th at Church of the Resurrection. Milaviv M. Curtis of Potosi, Wisconsin. For her, there will be services including a visitation from 4 to 7 p.m. today at St. Andrew Catholic Church in Tennyson, Wisconsin, followed by Mass of Christian Burial at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, October 19th at the church. Services for Anthony J. Goodkin of Manchester, Iowa, include visitation from 3:30 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, October 19th, and 9 to 10 a.m. Wednesday, October 20th, at Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Manchester. Mass of Christian Burial will be 10:30 a.m. Wednesday at St. John Catholic Church in Delhi. Services for John E. Graham of Dubuque include visitation from 2 to 4 p.m. today at Bear Funeral Home on Main Street and a funeral service at 4 p.m. today at the funeral home. Services for Linda L. Holmgren of Dubuque include a celebration of life from 5 to 7 p.m. on Friday, October 22nd at Carson Celebration of Life Center in Maquoketa. Services for William J. Kaiser of Hazel Green, Wisconsin include visitation from 9 to 11 a.m. Saturday, October 23rd at St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Sinsinawa. Service at 11 a.m. Saturday at the church. Services for Richard J. Killian of Boscobel include visitation from 9 to 11 a.m. today at St. Mary's Catholic Church Hall in Fenimore, Wisconsin, with service at 11 a.m. today at the church. Services for James E. Kopp of Platteville include visitation 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday with a rosary service at 3:30 p.m. at Melby Funeral Home and Crematory in Platteville, and 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. on Wednesday, October 20th at St. Mary's Catholic Church of Platteville. Mass of Christian Burial will be 10:30 a.m. on Wednesday at the church. Services for Marion L. Lamker of Monona include visitation 9 to 10 a.m. Saturday, October 23rd at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Monona. Service will be 10 a.m. Saturday at the church. Services for Forrest W. Monroe of Guttenberg include visitation from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Tuesday, October 19th at Schmitz Grau Home and Cremation Service in Ossian. Graveside service will be at 1:30 p.m. Tuesday at Pleasantville View Cemetery in Ossian. Services for Dwayne E. Poston of Prairie du Chien include visitation 9 to 11 a.m. Wednesday, October 20th at St. John's Church of the Holy Family Parish, Prairie du Chien. Mass of Christian Burial will be 11 a.m. Wednesday at the church. And services for Leonard G. Schuster of Dubuque include visitation from 9 to 11 a.m. Tuesday, October 19th at St. Joseph Key West Church. Mass of Christian Burial will be 11 a.m. Tuesday at the church. And that includes the obituaries and service announcements in Monday's Telegraph Herald. Turning to sports news, this week's finalists for Athlete of the Week include Maggie Furlong of Galena. The senior has floored 214 kills, an average of 44.1 per set, in leading the Pirates to a 27-0-1 record this season. Galena went a perfect 10-0 in the Northwest Upstate Illini Conference this season. Another finalist is Carter Olson of Cuba City. Carter Olson caught a touchdown, returned an interception for another score, and capped his hat trick with a kickoff return touchdown as the playoff-bound Cuba City Cubans, with a record of 7-2, rolled to a 64-13 victory over Ordfordville Parkville in the regular season finale. The third finalist is Kirsten Schmidt of Dyersville Beckman, another volleyball player. This senior leads Iowa Class 2A with 508 kills on 1,001 swings this season for the number 8-ranked Trailblazers. She also has 14 solo blocks and 21 assisted blocks. Schmidt will play at Iowa State University next season. To cast your vote, visit telegraphherald.com/athlete between 12:01 a.m. Monday and 5 p.m. on Tuesday. In college football highlights, Georgia leads the national football poll with a record of 7-0, followed by Oklahoma, which is also 7-0. Iowa dropped out of the top 10 to number 11 with a record of 6-1. In Saturday's results of local interest, South Dakota topped Northern Iowa in college football 34-21. Wisconsin beat Army 20-14. Iowa State beat Kansas State 33-20. San Diego topped Drake 13-10. And Iowa lost 24-7 at home to unranked Purdue. Monday's BizBuzz by Jeff Montgomery is titled Dubuque Store Opens New Chapter at Different Location. Mercantile on Main is Alice and Vicki Klinkhammer's renamed business venture. A community retail space that began in the Central Avenue corridor will soon start a new chapter in a different part of downtown Dubuque. The business, formerly known as Central Avenue Mercantile, recently closed its location at 1902 Central Avenue. Co-owner Alice Klinkhammer, who operates the business along with her mother Vicki, said the operation will relocate to 962 Main Street in November. The store already has changed its name to Mercantile on Main as a nod to its new surroundings. While the name may have changed, the emphasis on local makers and products remains firmly intact. Quote, "It is an artisan-based store," explained Alice. "Everything we sell is handcrafted or homemade." Much like its previous incarnation on Central Avenue, Mercantile on Main will offer booth spaces to tri-state vendors looking to sell their wares. The product selection will include everything from stained glass and paintings to wreaths and flower arrangements. Alice Klinkhammer's photography studio, Resonating Moments Photography, will also make the move to the 900 block of Main Street, operating in a space behind Mercantile on Main. It had previously operated within the Central Avenue location. Central Avenue Mercantile first opened in late 2019, and the Klinkhammers began operating the venture the following year. A new vision is beginning to take root at that structure, with the move poised, space poised to transition into a restaurant. When they realized that they would have to leave the Central Avenue location, the Klinkhammers initially feared they would have to close down the operation altogether. The discovery of the space at 962 Main Street vanquished those fears, however. Vicki has noticed a steady influx of tourists perusing her block of Main Street. On top of that, Mercantile on Main is located in close proximity to large employers who bring thousands of workers downtown each weekday. Weeks from opening, the excitement already is palpable. Quote, "We have had people walk in and ask what we are doing with the building and when we are going to open," Vicki said. "It's great to see. I think we will have a much better traffic flow in this new location." End quote. Turning to the lifestyle section of Monday's Telegraph Herald, Jason Howland of the Mayo Clinic News Network writes, "Flu during a pandemic." This is an installment of the Mayo Clinic Minute. Have you had your flu shot yet? The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends that everyone older than 6 months get a flu shot every season, with rare exceptions. Now in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic, it's important to be vaccinated for COVID-19 and the flu, and you can get both shots at the same time. Quote, "In most places, flu starts circulating by November, December, so it's recommended that everyone complete their flu vaccine by October," said Dr. Priya Sampathkumar, a Mayo Clinic infectious diseases specialist. Flu cases were low in 2020, and health experts attribute that to the COVID-19 pandemic and the preventive measures put out in place to reduce the spread of COVID-19. Quote, "We're afraid that with, in a lot of places, masking recommendations being relaxed, that flu will spread more easily. And the fact that no one had flu last year means there's a lot more people who are vulnerable this year," says Sampathkumar. Flu and COVID-19 are caused by respiratory viruses and have similar symptoms. Quote, "It's very, very hard, almost impossible, to distinguish the two just based on symptoms. Some cases of COVID can be very mild and present exactly like the flu. Some cases of flu can be very severe and present like COVID. So really, the only way to know for sure when you have a respiratory illness is to get tested," says Sampathkumar. And if you haven't been vaccinated for COVID-19 yet or need a third dose or a booster, you can get your flu shot and COVID vaccination at the same time. Quote, it's perfectly safe to get both at the same time, she says. Monday's installment of the Love That Lasts series is written by Olivia Garrett and titled, Local Couple Marks 60 Years of Marriage with, quote, PWP Model. Jack and Gail Hancock met in 1958, attended the same high school, and soon started dating. Jack and Gail Hancock have a motto, PWP. The initials stand for Pray, Work, and Play. That's how the Dubuque and Key West couple have spent the last 60 years of marriage, an anniversary milestone they reached Thursday. The first iteration of their relationship started in 1958 at the bowling alley. In 1961, the relationship was relaunched. They haven't faltered since. Quote, to be honest with you, I liked her from high school days, but I didn't get too involved, Jack said. I thought I'd wait. End quote. He would walk by her house on the way to school. Both went to St. Columbkeel High School, though Jack graduated from Dubuque Senior High School. They would see one another while at Dubuque Bowling Lanes and Crest Lanes in Dubuque. Around the time they both finished school, they started dating. It was casual, and they were young. They broke up. After a year of dating other people and considering one another friends, Jack decided to try again. Quote, it was a New Year's Eve, and I thought, well, I'll call her back up, Jack said. Then Gail Hamill. She didn't have any plans that night, so she decided to celebrate the New Year with Jack. By April, they were engaged. Quote, so that worked out, Jack said. They were married on October 14, 1961, at St. Columbkeel Catholic Church. Gail's sister and best friend, Marguerite Robinson, served as maid of honor. The reception was held at Happy's Place, a bar and live music venue owned by Jack's parents, Freeman and Doris Hancock. Happy was his father's nickname. Happy's would become an even larger part of their life. They bought the business in 1962. In 1963, Jack was drafted and sent overseas. He spent 18 months in Europe. Quote, it was a bummer, but we got through it, Gail said. When Jack came back, they would both tend bar at Happy's. They had country and Western music 3 days per week. Quote, we had the best clientele, Gail said, just the best people, end quote. In the late 1960s, the Hancocks welcomed two children, John Hancock and Jennifer Duffy. Bowling remained a part of the family's life. Everyone had their own ball. Every morning, while he was eating breakfast before school, John remembers seeing Jack give Gail a kiss. The children competed in sporting events, and the family went on vacations every summer. They lived above Happy's. Jack and Gail often were working, but they were always close by, John said. At dinner time, John and Jennifer would eat with Gail. Then she would go down to mind the business, and Jack would come up to eat his meal at the table with the children, John said. Jack and Gail organized trips around the country, taking people to Las Vegas, sporting events, and cruises. Once, they took 180 people to Tampa for a bowling tournament. The legalization of dog racing and gambling in Iowa shook up the tavern industry. Happy's needed more than just music to attract customers. So, Gail started serving food, and business picked back up. Quote, I know one thing. I married a good cook, Jack said. People always want me to go out to eat, but I always say I can't go out to eat and have better food than what I've got at home. End quote. In 1988, they sold Happy's to nephew Mark Hancock, who ran the business for 25 years. Gail and Jack continued to work at the business, but they moved to Key West, where they built a home. They had been longtime members of St. Columbkeel, but with the move, they decided to find a closer church. They had been members of St. Joseph Key West Catholic Church for many years. Jack volunteered at Mount Olivet Cemetery across the road, helping to care for the baby graves. The couple also often volunteered with the Sisters of the Presentation for the Blessed Virgin Mary, which Jack's twin sister, Janice Hancock, belonged to. Jack and Gail are big fans of the Green Bay Packers and the Atlanta Braves, dating back to the latter team's years in Milwaukee. Quote, Mom and Dad are avid sports fans, John said. They enjoy going to games, and in their Key West home, they set up a Packers-themed garage with a green and yellow floor and a table, chairs, and a bench bearing Packers colors and logos. Today, Jack and Gail have four grandchildren and two great-grandchildren. Jack said he and Gail care for one another in sickness and in health. Quote, the main thing is respect and love, Gail said. This article is accompanied by a photograph of Jack and Gail Hancock on their wedding day, October 14, 1961, and more recently as they stand at their home in Dubuque on Tuesday. The couple has been married for 60 years. Today's Doctors Oz and Royson column is titled, Eat Some Appealing Peels. Banana peels are a mainstay of slapstick comedy. Why? Well, Danny DeVito says it's because, quote, you have to give people permission to laugh. That's why they would always cut to the banana peel in the Laurel and Hardy movies, end quote. Turns out that there are a lot more uses for fruit and vegetable peels than finding amusement in another person's minor mishap. They're loaded with phytonutrients that can help keep you from slipping into poor health. Tip, wash skins very well and use organic produce if you're eating the peel. Peach skin delivers almost twice the number of polyphenols as peach flesh and a lot more fiber. A lab study showed that peach peel helps tamp down oxidative damage in the kidneys, liver, and brain. Eggplant skin, that's purple, contains a powerful antioxidant called nasunin that tamps down inflammation and a flavonoid called anthocyanins that promotes visual acuity, may protect against cancers, and protects cardiovascular health. Apple peels are highly appealing for flavor and crunch and their nutrients. A raw apple with skin contains up to 312% more vitamin K, 70% more vitamin A, 35% more calcium and potassium, and 30% more vitamin C than a peeled apple. Also, skin a medium apple and you get about 2 grams of fiber. Retain the peel and you'll get 4.4 grams. Watermelon rind is edible, raw, pickled, or sautéed, and contains the amino acid citrulline, which boosts the libido, improves erectile dysfunction, and dilates blood vessels. And the rind has fiber that eases digestion. And again, that's Doctors Oz and Royson column in Monday's Telegraph Herald. On the comics page, Monday's Frank and Ernest cartoon depicts them in an art museum acquisitions department. One says to the other, "How's it going?" The other says, "Another day, another dolly." Today's Ask Amy column by Amy Dickinson includes this letter. Dear Amy, both my husband and I get anxious as we see pumpkins appearing in shops. You see, both of our children have late November birthdays. They are the only grandchildren nieces on both sides of our families. Neither of our families live local to us, so beginning in mid-November, we start to feel a tidal wave of gifts entering our lives. Last year, both kids ended up with stuffed bedrooms and a mountain of toys in the playroom by the end of the holiday season. It was completely overwhelming. We have decided that in our immediate family, we are going to have birthdays and a Christmas that is more focused on experiences and less focused on gift-giving this year. My question is there a polite way to encourage our extended family to do the same? I am not blaming them for our clutter problem, but would love to somehow discourage the tidal wave, especially because it has been such a big project digging out and it feels really good to be more organized. What do you suggest? Signed, Decluttered. Dear Decluttered, you could send out a group email offering some direction. Tell them, quote, the season is upon us and we are anticipating birthdays and holidays. This year, we are trying to reduce the material abundance in our household and are encouraging people to send only one gift per child, or offer them experiences instead of material gifts. If you'd like ideas, we'd be happy to supply them, and as always, we are so grateful for your thoughtfulness and attention. Our children are very lucky. End quote. And we'll close with today's horoscope by Eugenia Last. If your birthday is today, and even if it isn't, a positive outlook will help you turn your dream into a reality. Comfort and convenience at home will make it easier to deal with sticky problems. Make decisions that will encourage a lifestyle that reflects who you are and what you want to do. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Monday, October 18th. I'm your reader, Paula Carrezzi. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening.
Exploring Science and the Sea. 100 million years ago, Kansas was inhabited by some creatures with big, sharp teeth. Sharks up to 30 feet long. A fish that's been described as a tarpon with fangs. And a 45-foot dinosaur that was one of the deadliest predators on the planet. That's because Kansas was at the bottom of a sea that stretched from the Arctic to the Gulf of Mexico. Known as the Western Interior Sea, it was up to 1,000 miles wide. Its warm, shallow waters supported an abundance of life, including giant clams, giant fish, and giant dinosaurs. The sea took shape when shifts in Earth's crust caused parts of North America to subside. The planet was so warm then that sea level was 1,000 feet higher than it is today. Ocean water spilled into North America from both north and south. By 100 million years ago, these fingers of water had linked up. The newly formed sea stretched from Alaska, through parts of the Mountain West and the Great Plains, and down through Texas. That divided the continent into western and eastern halves, known as Laramidia and Appalachia. The contours of the Western Interior Sea varied over the millennia, and sediments created vast beds of limestone. About 65 million years ago, a gap appeared in the sea, breaking it into northern and southern branches. They quickly retreated, reuniting the two halves of North America, but leaving behind a fossil record that tells us about life in this ancient American sea. Science in the Sea, a production of the University of Texas Marine Science Institute, is on the web at scienceandthesea.org. I'm Holly Brawley.